This podcast is sponsored by ebookit.com, self-publishing solutions for the independent author and small press. Visit us today at ebookit.com.
Welcome to the Toastmasters podcast, the official podcast of Toastmasters International. Hello, everybody. This is Greg Gazin.
And I'm Ryan Levesque.
We are often so focused on our content and delivery that we often overlook one critical factor: audience engagement. Virtual and remote delivery adds an additional level of complexity, but our guest today is an expert, and she's going to help us navigate this long and winding road. Ryan, who are we speaking with today?
Kathy Armias is a three-time distinguished Toastmaster and a member of TV Toastmasters and Toastmasters for Speaking Professionals, both in Portland, Oregon. She's an international speaker, marketing expert, TED coach, and author of How to Rock a TED Talk. Kathy's article, 8 Tips for Engaging Your Audience, Break Through the Invisible Wall with Questions, Stories, and More, is in the January 2022 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. Kathy Armias, welcome to the Toastmasters podcast.
Welcome.
Hey. How's it going, Ryan and Greg?
Kathy, if you could perhaps define engagement and tell us why it's important.
I think people, when they get asked to give a speech, I mean, think outside of the Toastmaster realm too, when somebody comes to you and they say, oh, you have to do this speech, whether it be, I mean, the very first public speech I ever did was at a friend's funeral. And of course, like the first thing your mind goes to is like, oh my God, I got to put this speech together. What am I going to say? And everything becomes so much about me, me. What am I going to say? How am I going to say it? Which is fine. But then sometimes it gets us into that weird space where we totally forget there's an audience beyond this invisible wall in between me and them. And if I can't get them engaged into what I'm saying, or if they can't relate, or if they don't feel it, or if they don't change their mind, what's the purpose? I'm just speaking to talk. I really feel like this is a critical component.
You referenced your first public speech being at a funeral. I'm interested to know, Kathy, your progression as a speaker. When did Toastmasters come into the picture for you?
I was working as the director of marketing at a industrial shredder manufacturer, shredding large things like cars and boats and things like that. The woman who was running HR for the company said, you know, you should come to Toastmasters. And this was back in early 2000s. And I remember going, like, of course, like many of us, like, ooh, what's Toastmasters? And when I went, I realized that Toastmasters started really hitting my creative brain so much. Like, okay, you're not just giving a speech. Oh, you're not just doing a marketing campaign. Like, how do you actually do something that gets through and causes your audience to connect? And it was funny because I went on to do a campaign right after I started Toastmasters for the industrial shredder company. And it was called Watch It Shred, where I put up a bunch of shredding videos. And funny enough, in this weird way, I credit it to Toastmasters because it caused me to learn how to kind of go through the computer screen and grab the audience. And that particular campaign went super viral and ended up on the David Letterman show, CNN, CNBC. And then we had 2 reality TV series. It all kind of came from that space where I was sitting there trying to come up with speeches for Toastmasters.
Kathy, you just briefly mentioned and touched upon a key point in your article, which is the progression of a speaker's focus from when they're first learning to speak to when they become an experienced speaker who can make an impact on the stage. And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about that progression and where you tend to see people start and then where they ideally can get to.
It always starts with me, I, and you know, when it becomes really powerful, it is when it switches to you or them. It's a really simple concept, but it's also really hard in practice. I remember starting off in Toastmasters. I remember my icebreaker speech. It was titled 3 Things About Kathy with an E. So we're taught right out of the gate, talk about you. You know yourself really well. I think that's really smart from Toastmasters. That's where we start. Our goal in Toastmasters is to get people comfortable with the stage, get people to be able to speak and not be super nervous. But as you progress, you need to understand that you're not speaking for you. You're speaking for them. And, you know, I get really detailed when I'm coaching somebody. You can take a story that's your own story and you can ask some questions. I call it the art of popping out of your story. You pop out of the story for a second and you ask the audience a question to see if they can relate, or you just kind of build it into the story, but you have to make your stories their stories. I call it the IU balance. So when I'm working with my clients, I'm like, oh, check your IU balance.
Is it a progression of mindset, would you say, or is it a progression of technique?
It's both, for sure.
Yeah.
It's definitely a mindset, of course, because again, at the beginning, you are not concerned about your audience. You are super concerned about yourself. You're nervous. When you're first speaking, you're like, oh gosh, I have to speak. Oh my gosh, I'm next. You know, and all you're thinking about is yourself. You're not thinking, oh, that audience, they really need to hear this. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not in that space. And so I do think that shifts. I think you start to get excited when you become more of a seasoned speaker. When you speak and you see that your audience is engaging, or they're nodding their head with you, or they're going with you, or somebody comes up to you after and says, I really loved what you said, and here's why. And it starts shifting your own mindset. But I think also in technique, you start realizing what works and what doesn't. You start to pay attention, and then you go, oh, that did not work. That story, that 9-minute story about me playing softball did not work. I don't think people could relate. So yeah, it's both.
Kathy, I'm wondering, what is it about specific stories that actually drives engagement? We always hear about telling great stories and compelling stories and creating great imagery, but what specifically about them actually drives engagement?
Here's my funny thing. You hear it in the TED world a lot. Just tell your story. I think it's the worst advice ever. It's like, just tell a story. Just tell your story. Stories can be horrible. They can be long. They can be boring. There's definitely a technique to it. Think about it from the audience perspective. What makes you feel like you can go along with that story? A, if you feel like you're in it somehow. B, if you're intrigued. C, if you're horrified. I mean, there's a lot of emotions I think we can attach to it, but we somehow have to feel connected to it. And if I feel like somebody's just being a news reporter and reporting the news or retelling something as opposed to making me feel like they're reliving that space again, I'm not really interested. Unless by lucky chance, you're talking about something that I really, really care about.
I noticed in the article that you referenced quite a cross-section of people. And then rather than the typical platform speaker or professional speaker that we would usually reference, you chose a lawyer, an ad exec, a musician. And in fact, the opening of the article, the hero is actually a motorcycle safety instructor. And for me, that was like, okay, what is she going to say next? I mean, you had me a motorcycle.
Oh, I watched this guy do magic on The Room. I was like, oh, I have to sit for 3 days with this guy for me to get my license. And he did the most brilliant thing. So imagine the setting. There's a bunch of young boys in the room that definitely had phones out and were not engaging at all. He spent a good chunk of time going around the room and asking people their names. But what he really was doing was coming up with a seating map. And all he did for all of the content was have us be engaged in it. He'd say, so Kathy, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, Ryan, Greg. And so you were always sitting there going, oh God, he's going to call my name. And I have to follow along. I have to know exactly where. So it just punched me in the face how engaged everybody was. So there you go. It was a technique, right? And he probably learned it from doing this over and over and over. And now it's probably become a mindset. He probably carries that in everything he does because he learned it so well in that context.
You know, so you pick professionals who speak rather than professional speakers. How did you come up with the examples? How did you decide which ones were going to work?
I coach a lot of different people for TED Talks and various things. And that kept hitting me a lot. There's a big divide in between what you just said. There's people that have to engage their audience and they might not get paid to speak, but they have to engage their audience in their work. And so I just started kind of culling through my brain and I wanted to get a wide variety and a diverse variety of these different types of professions. Think about a lawyer, for instance. A trial lawyer will not win any cases if they can't engage the jury. They never would.
Right.
They have to. It's critical. Way more critical than a professional speaker. We could walk off the stage and go, yep, totally bombed that. Like lose an entire case. Like that's something totally different.
Yeah. Right. People's lives are in your hands. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
As a speaker, so you still get paid even if it goes poorly.
Right. You feel guilty and you get paid. Right. But think about the musician too, like Red Ray Frazier. I've seen a couple of his shows. He's so soft-spoken when he talks, and it amazed me how he could take an audience. He's opened for several people and done his own shows. And when I saw him one time opening an act, and it was really loud in the room, and then all of a sudden he came on very soft-spoken, and he just, everybody gravitated to every word he said. And so I thought, wow, that'd be fascinating to see what he said. And it was something that we know, right? Just be open and vulnerable. Tell the truth. The audience will be on your side. I'm nervous too. I still do this and get nervous. It's funny how some of their tips weren't things that we've heard before, but we now see them in a different context of how other people use them.
Yeah, that's true. I'm sure I was told many times is that don't tell people you're nervous. Don't focus on yourself because it's not about you. It's about the audience. And this seems to be a different take on it.
Kathy, one of my favorite of your 8 tips for engaging your audience that you shared in your article is about asking powerful questions. If a question is posed properly, I think it can get people immediately involved in the conversation without having to try to convince them or cajole them to get involved. It's just, boom, they're instinctively in the conversation. And I think it would be really helpful for our audience to take the theoretical into the practical and understand what that looks like. If you could maybe share an example of how you've used powerful questions to engage your audience.
Now we're kind of getting into this space where you're moving from the mindset to the practicality of it. Like, how can you put in questions that don't seem cliche or, you know, I think you mentioned it before too. You start off a speech and you say, can you imagine yourself? Where people are like, oh boy, here we go. Where it feels contrived, as opposed to a TED Talk where they're asking a question or they're posing something that you've never really thought about before. They really challenge your thinking and make you think maybe you are wrong or maybe what you believe to be true is not true. I worked one time with an NBA performance coach. Again, another space where he used speaking for his profession, but not as much as a speaker, but he got asked to speak to a couple of different conventions in his space. I posed a powerful question to him, which is what we base the entire speech on. This was the question. I said, how do you make people fall in love with something they believe they hate? And he was like, oh, that's so good, right? He almost lost his mind. He was like, wow. We started with that powerful question, but then he ended up incorporating that actual question into his talk. He liked it so much. He rewarded it in a little bit of a different way. Now he's talking to people like him. He's talking to other performance coaches. How do you make your players fall in love with something they believe they hate, something they believe they don't want to do? And he posed this question, and I think it caused people to really engage in thought. They engaged immediately and thought, yeah, how do we do that? I think powerful questions are a great space. If the audience doesn't feel like they're being grilled or they're being questioned, so to speak, I think that out of the gate can make it feel really powerful. Like, it's a sneaky question almost, right? You ask a question and it was like their brain immediately has to answer it. Their brain is searching for the answer, but it wasn't necessarily this contrived, like, have you ever had a moment where you were sitting in your car and you didn't know? And they're like, oh, okay, here we go. As opposed to where you slip something in and it's that moment where we as speakers all know about, where you're speaking and then you see people engage in a way where either they put their phone down or they write something down or they look up or they change. I think that's what it can cause people to do, is really engage their mind.
That question in particular, how do you make people fall in love with something that they believe they hate? Mm-hmm. When you asked it, it just brought up curiosity and, wait, there's actually an answer to that question? What right. could it possibly be? Right. And so now I'm like, you're going to have to tell me after the interview who this guy is and how I can find a copy of his presentation, because I want to know.
I was thinking Brussels sprouts, right?
Or even simple questions. What makes you believe you're wrong? How can you be addicted to better? These are some of the things in that space that we were working on. Those were some of the questions that we were thinking about. But I think you're right, Greg. That's the thing that it does. Immediately, your brain has to try to answer it. Your brain's going, wait, what? I don't, well, yeah, how can I do that? What do I hate? You start, so you're answering different parts of the question too. Mm. Asking powerful questions, it might be a little bit akin to comedy. You have to know how to deliver these questions. That's part of the issue. People will say, oh, technique, just ask a question, just tell a story. No, do it right. Like, do it well.
Without divulging any trade secrets, I'm just wondering if there's an example, whether it be the MBA example, or there's a different example of here's the question and here are some of the epiphanies or here's some of the techniques that were actually used.
I worked with the CEO of a company called Wildfang. The CEO left Nike to start a women's clothing company, and she ended up giving a TED talk, and we were working with her on the idea, just talking about what's going to be kind of the basis of your whole TED talk. And we ended up getting to a place where she wanted people to say to her, yeah, maybe, could I start a clothing company there for women, but it's really tomboyish? Yeah, maybe. She wanted the yeah, maybe people in her life as opposed to the yeah, rights. She said one of her friends told her, yeah, you're right. You can't start a clothing company. You're the like most unfashionable person I know. You know, that was a response from one of her friends. She was searching for the yeah, maybes. We posed questions around the yeah, maybe. Are you surrounding yourself with people that can ask you, yeah, maybe? It's such a unique idea. Her talk could have just been the cliche, find people around you that will support you, that will give their full support to you. Okay, cool. That's cliche. But she found a way to say it. And the way that she posed it was through the yeah, maybe, as opposed to the yeah, right.
Wow. Yeah, maybe. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, maybe you could do that. In the talk, actually, she asked herself a couple of questions, which was really powerful. So this was kind of part of the technique. She was having a conversation with herself, but the audience was answering those questions, right? So she said, so I woke up one night and it was something like this. And she said, I asked myself, could I really start a company from scratch that I know nothing about? I don't even know how to start a website. Yeah, maybe. Could I get the funding to start this international clothing company on my own? Yeah, maybe. So she was running through a series of questions. Could I break into an industry that I really know little to nothing about? Yeah, maybe. As she went through her own yeah, maybes, she's inviting the audience to go along with these crazy, wild thoughts. And I think that's what kind of engages us. Even though you might not be starting a women's clothing company, your brain's kind of following along going, yeah, could I do that? That's interesting. I could see the issue with that.
The yeah, maybe seems to open up the door to possibilities. And when you say that, that's almost a trigger for the mm-hmm. audience to start thinking.
There's something about the yeah, maybe versus the heck yeah, I can. With the heck yeah, I can, it's, you feel like you're lying to yourself. But with the yeah, maybe, there's the, well, maybe. I mean, maybe is always a correct answer. But it does, like Greg was saying, it cracks that door open to the possibility and makes you start to get curious about, well, if I did, what might that look like?
Yeah, the other part is sort of overly optimistic, unrealistic, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Now I'm thinking you're preparing these powerful questions, but I'm also curious. In the article, you make reference to improv speakers. And I'm thinking, now that must be a real challenge. I mean, you'd think that the improv speaker would be heavily focused on trying to make sure that he or she is trying to string together a bunch of cohesive thoughts, keep the words flowing without any awkward pauses and silences. And I'm thinking, how are they going to be trying to make sure they're focused on keeping the engagement?
Have either one of you ever done improv?
Sort of poorly.
Same for me.
Back in early 2020, I dove into it for the first time ever. And as a TED coach, I was mortified. I was like, this is horrible. This is the worst thing ever. This has nothing to do with speaking. It's terrible. It has nothing to do with what I teach. And then I found out I was really wrong. You know what improvers do? Really good improvers like Gary Hirsch, who I featured in this article, they practice so that they can improv in the moment. But what they're really practicing is how to engage their audience in that moment, how to engage with the people that they're on stage with. The big thing with improv is you have to say yes and, right? You have to agree with everything that comes your way. If you really look at the trajectory of a speaker, we do the same things. I teach my speakers to never memorize a speech, but to internalize it. Even the same speech with a different audience, you have to be in that moment with that audience. And you may say something completely different just based on the feedback that you're getting, whether that be, you know, visual or kind of just the energy in the room. So you can't be that speaker that's like, no, I have this perfectly memorized, polished speech. And so in some ways, we're constantly improvising.
I'm just thinking for yourself, has there been a time where you had to improvise? Not on purpose, not that you're doing improv, but you're presenting to an audience. I mean, obviously, you've presented to major audiences. You've done TED Talks. You presented for Nike. Have you ever found yourself in a situation that, okay, this isn't working, I'm not connecting, and you had to shift on the fly?
Yes. One time I had to improvise. It was about 200 people in a room, and I got to a Q&A part of my session. And somebody actually asked me something personal. They said that they think that their boyfriend went to high school with me. And I was like, ah, it threw me. I just was not prepared for a question like that. It choked me up for a second. And then I started responding. And then I was like, wait a minute, there's 199 other people here that don't care about her boyfriend or me going to high school together. So I was like, take this offline. It would hit me. There was another time, maybe 5-6 years ago, and I was speaking to really young entrepreneurs. And I realized I didn't want to be that cliche person that's like, hey, you guys don't even know what a rotary phone is. I hate when people do that. I hate when people like patronize their audience. I hate that. And so I found myself saying examples though, and they were staring at me like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And on the fly, I was like, oh, I better change up. So I had to come up with examples in my head of things that might've happened in the last 10 years, not things that have happened in the last 20 or 30. So yeah, I think you have to be prepared in every moment, in every story, to improvise and do it well. And you practice that and you speak, and that's why you prepare. I think we prepare wrong sometimes. I think sometimes we prepare for the specific word or the specific speech. And I think that preparing is a bigger thing. I think you should prepare being a better storyteller in general, being a better improviser in general, being a better audience engager in general. I think that's what can make you a really great speaker, not just a good speaker.
This talk of improv, Kathy, conjures up images in my mind of the theater, which is a perfect lead-in to my next question for you. There's a really key concept in your article that you mentioned the word once, but we kind of glossed over it, and I'd like to bring it center stage, so to speak. And it's the idea of the invisible wall. Mm-hmm. Now, before you talk about that, as soon as I read it in your article, my mind went to what's called the fourth wall and breaking the fourth wall in, say, a play or a television show or a movie, which is when the actor addresses the audience, which you don't typically have that happen in a play, for example. The actors are addressing each other. I'd love to hear your explanation as to what you see as the difference between breaking the fourth wall and breaking what you call the invisible wall.
That's what it was based on. But what I realized is that breaking the fourth wall, of course, we saw it very famously in the TV show The Office, and people fell in love with that. And there were these moments where they're like, oh my gosh, they're looking right at me. They're talking to me. That's weird. Not used to that. With speakers, it's beyond that. It's not just breaking the wall and talking to the audience. We do that a lot. Sometimes it's just being aware that there is something in between you and the audience. And as the communicator, the speaker, the presenter, the TED speaker, the whatever it is, it's your job to break it down. And if it's there, if that invisible wall's up, I believe that you're not getting through to them. You can't just say that the only way to get through to an audience is to talk directly to them. That's pretty weak, I think. You have to find more brilliant ways to do it. For instance, I have this little story vignette, and I'll show you two different really quick ways that you could tell a story, right? I could tell it one way that's totally my perspective. I can say, hey, I woke up at 2:30 in the morning the other night. I was so craving my favorite ice cream. I love chocolate. Ben and Jerry's chocolate therapy is my absolute favorite. It's just 2:30 in the morning. I decided to get in my car, 2:30 in the morning, put on a jacket, flip-flops, and go to the store. I got there and it wasn't there. I was so mad. So that story is 100% me. Now, can I break the invisible wall down just by kind of including the audience into it? I could even start off with that kind of question. Have you ever crave something so much that you'd be willing to go to great lengths. Like maybe you really, really, really love chocolate. What if you woke up in the middle of the night one night and you craved chocolate? Maybe your favorite ice cream is Ben and Jerry's Chocolate Therapy, or maybe you really love cookies and cream and you just had to have it. Would you be willing to get up and drive to the store in the middle of the night to go get it? What if they didn't have it? It's really a simplistic way. It's just me flipping the story, making it your story. Even if any of those things didn't apply to you, your brain is answering. Your brain's going, nope, don't like chocolate at all. Nope, don't like, you know, nope, I would never do that. You're already engaged. So, I mean, that's kind of level one, but how can we break that wall down? And it doesn't always have to be in a direct question.
What I'm hearing and you're sharing, Kathy, is when you're breaking the fourth wall, you're addressing the audience, which a speaker is always doing, right?
Yes.
I mean, they should be.
Yes.
Sometimes right? they're addressing their PowerPoint slides projected right. up on the wall.
Reading them.
But when you've successfully broke the invisible wall, you've gone from speaking to the audience to everything we've been talking about today, which is engaging with the audience. That's what breaking the invisible wall is, as I understand it.
Yeah, totally. As speakers, we need to have that thought in mind. There's an invisible wall. I watched this thing the other day, you guys. This is really funny. I watched this thing the other day. I don't know how it came across. I'm really into rap, and I saw the rapper Logic, and he was in Sweden, and there was like a 14-year-old girl that he brought on stage, and she rapped with him, and she rapped faster and better than he did and just won the audience over.
Wow.
It was amazing. And I was like, I'm going to turn that into one of the things I coach, like the sing my song concept. When you're speaking on something, by the end of your talk, you should get the audience to feel like they could sing your song, right? It has to feel like it's theirs or that they're, right? Like you're that connected to it that they could go and do it too. Have you ever left a speech or presentation and you told somebody else about it and you really felt like you encapsulated it well? I mean, somebody's going and singing your song. So at the end of the day, that's what you want.
It's interesting because, first of all, I'm fully engaged right now. But what I also realized is that there's a number of techniques that you can use to engage while you're on stage, but it starts really in the preparation and the planning. And folks, there's a lot of golden nuggets that we haven't even had an opportunity to talk about. Please make sure you check out Kathy's article in the January 2022 issue of the Toastmaster magazine. And if you found this episode engaging, please share. Please let people know so that they too can learn how to become engaged. You can find the Toastmasters podcast at toastmasterspodcast.com, toastmasters.org, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Kathy, this really has been great. You are a wealth of knowledge, experience, and wisdom. For our listeners who want to learn more from you, Kathy Armias, what's the best way for them to connect?
Well, I'm the only Kathy Armias in the world. So if you search me anywhere, you'll find me. If you search Kathy Armias, you'll find my website, you'll find my Facebook, you'll find my Instagram, you'll find my Twitter, LinkedIn, etc.
And that's Kathy with an E.
Kathy with an E.
Well, Kathy Armias, it has been a total pleasure. Thank you so much. Wish you a successful 2022.
Thank you all. This was great. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kathy.
Isn't it about time you published that book you've been thinking about? We can help with that. At ebookit.com, we've been providing authors and small presses with ebook publishing services since 2010. Visit us today at ebookit.com and let us know how we can help you.